Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the author of the explosive new book, which makes the case that the man in the White House, Donald Trump, is an asset of the Putin government and is in debt to Russian organized crime known as the Mafia. Craig Unger, the author of the New York Times bestseller House of Bush, House of Saud, who has written about the Trump-Russia scandal for The New Republic and Vanity Fair, joins us to discuss his latest book, just out, House of Trump, House of Putin, The Untold Story of Donald Trump and the Russian Mafia. We'll discuss how Trump started doing business with Russian gangsters in 1984 when he sold 5 condos to a Russian mobster, David Bogatin, for $6 million in cash, and how the richer Trump got, the deeper he sank into the Russian criminal underworld, ending up with Trump selling 1,300 condos in the U.S. to Russians in all cash purchases through anonymous sources. We'll assess why it is difficult for Americans to get their heads around the possibility that their president is a traitor, even though the evidence of compromise was in plain sight for all the world to see at the press conference that followed the secret meeting between Trump and Putin in Helsinki, at which Trump displayed a sickening submissiveness to his case officer in the Kremlin. Then we'll look into the claims by the Russian Ministry of Defense that their military involvement in Syria was much more extensive than previously thought, with the head of the Russian Duma Defense Committee boasting that Russia deployed 63,012 military personnel who saw combat experience in Syria, with its Air Force destroying 121,466 so-called terrorist targets, killing 86,000 so-called militants, while testing 231 new weapon systems. An expert on Syria, Nicholas Harris, a fellow at the Center for New American Security, joins us to discuss how Russia has secured a foothold in the Middle East while increasing its arms sales across the region. Then finally, we will go to Iowa City to speak with Timothy Hagel, a professor of political science at the University of Iowa, who teaches judicial politics and behavior, American politics, and public administration. He joins us to discuss how the death of Molly Tibbetts, allegedly at the hands of an undocumented Mexican farmhand who worked for a prominent Republican family, has become politicized by President Trump and Iowa's Governor Kim Reynolds and amplified by Fox News over the objections of members of the victim's family. And joining us now is Craig Unger, the author of the New York Times bestseller House of Bush, House of Saud, the former deputy editor of the New York Observer and editor-in-chief of Boston Magazine. He has written about the Trump-Russia scandal for The New Republic and Vanity Fair, and his new book just out is House of Trump, House of Putin, The Untold Story of Donald Trump and the Russian Mafia. Welcome to Background Briefing, Craig Unger.
Thanks for having me.
Well, thanks, Craig. And the point you're making essentially here is that there is a Russian asset in the White House, and I think compromise was in plain view to the whole world at the press conference that took place after the secret meeting between Putin and Trump in Helsinki. But it's going to be very hard. I think it's very hard for Americans to get their head around the idea that a hostile foreign power led by a former intelligence officer is able to pull off what would be the greatest coup in, I think, intelligence history, not to mention political history. It rivals the Germans putting Lenin in a boxcar in 1917 and sending him back to Russia. So is that the problem we're having here? Not just that the Mueller investigation is taking place in secret, unlike the Watergate hearings, but that it's just difficult for the average American to get their head around what is really going on here.
Well, it was certainly hard for me to wrap my mind around it, and I did it piece by piece and tried to. I think you can't understand this unless you understand the history and you go back to the beginning. And that's why I went back more than 30 years to the late 70s and early 80s. And I found, you know, Trump has always said he has zero contacts with Russia. Well, I found at least 59 intermediaries between Trump and various Russian transactions. And when you put them all together, I think you start to see the big picture. And I tried to assemble what is either sort of a roadmap, a blueprint that I think Robert Mueller is exploring. And two of those pieces, of course, started to unravel this week with Michael Cohen and Paul Manafort.
Well, you could make the case, I think, that Paul Manafort's compromise by Oleg Deripaska is a similar model to how the Russian mob and the oligarchs sort of got Trump hooked on their money and therefore control him because, you know...
Right, absolutely. Yes, absolutely. And in a lot of ways, when you see Paul Manafort, you know, was this big-time Washington lobbyist, and he was renowned for lobbying for the dictators and the torturers, and he and his compatriot, Roger Stone, would revel in the sleaze that they were working for these tyrants all over the world. Well, in 2006 and 2010, Manafort started doing that in Ukraine and installed as president Viktor Yanukovych, who was essentially a Putin puppet as president of the Ukraine. And in many ways, I kind of think of that as a dry run for what Manafort did in 2016 with Donald Trump.
And Ukraine is key to all of this, going back to the beginning, 84, with David Bogatin, who bought 5 apartments in Trump Towers for $6 million in cash. And that eventually created a pipeline to Donald Trump from Russian gangsters and oligarchs, where at least 1,300 of Trump condos in the United States have been sold in a similar way with cash purchases through anonymous sources. So both Bogatin and Semyon Mogilevich, they made their money out of the Ukrainian gas scam, which also funded the politicians in the woman, Yulia, that...
Tymoshenko.
Yeah, yep. She was on the take, and so, of course, was Yanukovych. So that seems to be a big part of it, isn't it?
Right. Well, I think there are at least two money pipelines, and that's one of them, and it's sort of the Ukraine energy trade. And what you see is the Russian mafia siphoning off about $1 billion a year, somewhere between $750 million and $1 billion a year. And obviously they want to keep that going, so they need political support in Ukraine, and that's what Yanukovych provided, and Paul Manafort made sure that he was in place. And then they wanted to do similar things in the United States, and Donald Trump became president.
So we start in 84 with Bogatin and Mogilevich. He's, of course, still on the FBI's 10 most wanted, and the FBI referred to him as the boss of bosses. It seems, though, that given how early these ties were back to the 80s, my understanding is that Trump's trip in 1987, when Ivana, his Czech wife, acted as his interpreter, she, by the way, took the kids every summer to Czechoslovakia, then under part of the Warsaw Pact. She basically, those kids all, I think, were very much influenced by their sort of Slavophile attitudes. But my understanding is that the Soviets saw in Donald Trump a replacement for Armin Hammer. They wanted a prominent American businessman as a conduit. Is that your understanding?
Well, there's yes, it really is very much something like that. It's not clear exactly when they thought of him as a potential presidential candidate, but even in 87, when he came back to the United States, he actually started to run for president in 1988. He went to New Hampshire and did, this was with the Reform Party. It didn't get very far because the Reform Party was never going to get into the debates. But he took out full-page ads in the New York Times, the Washington Post, and the Boston Globe that reflecting a new direction in foreign policy that was very much in favor of Russia. And it's the same kind of anti-European foreign policy that he's pursuing today.
And again, I'm speaking with Craig Unger, the author of the New York Times bestseller, House of Bush, House of Saud. He's the former deputy editor of the New York Observer and editor-in-chief of Boston Magazine, and has written about the Trump-Russia scandal for the New Republic and Vanity Fair. And his new book just out is House of Trump, House of Putin, The Untold Story of Donald Trump and the Russian Mafia. So you talked to an old friend of mine who I spent some time with in Russia, General Oleg Kalugin, who was a former resident in Washington and ran a lot of very successful American spies for the Soviet Union, Putin has a hit out on him, by the way. He basically says in your book that you have to understand that the mafia, the Russian mafia, is just another branch of the KGB. They had a relationship, of course, that predated the collapse of the Soviet Union, because the KGB was regulating the informal black market that was run by the Chechen mafia and other mafia groups in the Vori Vazakone, the traditional Russian criminals. So that relationship is at the heart, is it not, of the new Russia. It's in its DNA.
Absolutely. And in fact, I was able to get transcripts of files from Ukrainian intelligence talking about Vladimir Putin's relationship with the mafia and directly with Mogilevich. So this is not a matter of speculation. And I think it's something that's a little hard for Americans to wrap their minds around. It has to be unpacked a bit, because most of us, when you hear the word mafia, you think of the Godfather and the Italian-American mafia. But as you say, it's absolutely true that, and Kalugin told me this, that the Russian mafia is essentially an arm of the KGB. And when you then look at how they bought so many Trump properties, and many of them have lived there and have made it their base of operations from time to time, that raises really, really serious questions, because they are in the home of the man who is president of the United States, and they have direct ties to Russian intelligence. And this seems to me a spectacular security breach. We've seen John Brennan's security clearance taken away from him. Let me suggest Donald Trump in a million years should never have gotten a security clearance.
Well, that is the irony, of course, among many ironies. But Brennan actually made the case when he was questioned by Rachel Maddow, who was questioning him on his charge of that Trump's performance at the press conference after the secret meeting with Putin in Helsinki was nothing short of treasonous. When pressed by Rachel Maddow, Brennan actually made the case that she could argue that Trump committed treason in that press conference, because Brennan, Clapper, the head of the NSA, and Comey, and three of these people are under attack by Trump as we speak, they were the ones who briefed him on January the 6th of 2017 and said, look, the Russians really did it. They provided Trump with absolutely tons of unambiguous evidence that it happened. And Trump then, in front of the whole world, sides with Putin, that Putin had nothing to do with meddling in the elections, which he knew was not true. At least he knew that his intelligence services told him otherwise. So any American commander-in-chief and president would have said, yes, Putin did it, and turn, look Putin in the eye and said, and don't do it again. That is his job. That's what a commander-in-chief would do. This guy betrayed his oath of office and betrayed the United States. And God knows why these people in the Fox bubble don't see that. It's just, I find it extraordinary.
Right. No, well, I agree entirely. And I guess one of the things I discovered in this, and it was sort of horrifying, is that, you know, if you go back 30 years, of course Russia did not know he would become president eventually. And when I talked to General Kalugin, he described America as a paradise if you were a Russian spy. And he said there were at least 300 American spies working for Russia, or American assets working for Russia. And Trump appears to have been one of them. And you see Russian money flowing into the Republican Party for more than 20 years. If you go back to Speaker of the House Tom DeLay and the lobbyist Jack Abramoff from 20 years ago, why were they always flying off to Moscow? And they started to use the various mechanisms in our electoral system, the K Street lobbyists, the super PACs and campaign finance. They learned that system, and Russian money began flooding into the Republican Party.
So what's behind that? Citizens United, of course, opened the floodgates. And it's interesting to note that just after Citizens United, when Obama delivered the State of the Union, when he said what a terrible ruling it was and the consequences would be dire and that foreign money would pour into our elections, and there in the audience, Justice Alito mouthed, not true. Well, Obama was right and Alito has been proven wrong. Foreign money has flowed in, And by the way, as much as we're looking at the Russian money that flowed into the elections, there's also money came in from Saudi Arabia and the Emiratis, which is, I think, another shoe that's going to drop.
Right, right. And we see some of this going on through various mechanisms that may be legal. Russian money, for example, goes to the National Rifle Association, and then it goes into Republican candidates. Similarly, we see an oligarch named Leonard Blavatnik, who is a naturalized American citizen, a multi-billionaire, and suddenly he gives $11 million to the Republican Senatorial Campaign Committee, which Mitch McConnell oversees.
So just to sort of wrap up in the last couple of minutes here, Craig, there's so much we could talk for hours, but the latest breaking stuff, particularly with Trump's lawyer and fixer, Michael Cohen, making it clear that he is going to testify against Trump. The Steele dossier has him making a secret trip to the Czech Republic, where he met with Russian intermediaries and arranged for the payments for these Russian hackers who did all of the hacking of the DNC and of Podesta, etc. So that's a hell of a smoking gun if he'll testify to prove the veracity of the Steele dossier, which so far has stood up.
Right, right. No, Michael Cohen is a fascinating figure, and I think a lot of stuff is going to unravel regarding him. For many years, he's been at the nexus of the Russian mafia's ties here. He and his family owned a restaurant, social club called El Carib, that has basically been the headquarters for the Russian mafia in Brooklyn for many years. He's had casino boats off the coast of Florida that have ties to the Russians, and through his in-laws, he has ties to various Russian oligarchs. So he plays a very important role here, and he's collected many, many tapes over the years, and it'll be fascinating to what comes out of that.
So what's going to break this sort of bubble of delusion where 30% of the country are immune to facts or evidence? You know, after the dramatic events on Tuesday with the sentencing of Manafort and Trump's lawyer and fixer copping a plea, that, of course, is not being reported by Fox. They're talking about the undocumented Mexican who murdered the young girl.
They had a big story on whether a giraffe is just a kind of a horse.
Right. So that's what's going on. So I don't know how you can continually deny reality. And obviously, Mueller's at a disadvantage because he's operating in secret and he's not saying anything. So what's your reading on, obviously, your book is going to break through a little bit into that mm-hmm. world, but do you see any kind of major breakthrough happening here, maybe the indictment of Donald Jr. or Jared? What will it take?
Well, I think it really takes impeachment hearings and nationally televised hearings. That this has to, the floodgates have to open up in a way that hasn't happened yet. Manafort and Michael Cohen are two very, very, very important pieces of the puzzle. Their whole stories are not known by America yet. There are important characters like Felix Sater, who is not yet a household name and who may become one. That has to happen in the way it happened in Watergate. And even then, you know, I'm old enough to remember Watergate, and it took a long time for things to break through. In the end, Nixon still had, like, 20-25% support. So there are some diehards who will never leave him. Mm-hmm. But you're absolutely right. I think a huge portion of the Republican Party is simply denying facts and denying reality, and they create their own facts, and that seems to be a world they can continue to live in. That has to change in November if the Democrats take the House.
Well, just in closing, obviously from the body language, from the submissiveness of Trump, he's either terrified of Putin or Putin has compromise on him. But because of his long relations with Russian gangsters, preceded by him and his father's relations with Italian gangsters, there's nobody scarier than the Russian mob. And that seems to be why Manafort is terrified of Deripaska, who he stole money from. And that's why he did all those fraudulent bank deals, which he just got convicted on. He could be killed in an American prison. So I guess that's the easiest place to have people killed. So I think Mueller has some leverage over him. But what do you think Trump is terrified of? Because he's really afraid they have something on him. That's pretty obvious.
Well, you know, I've talked to people, including General Kalugin, who said they had compromise on him, and this was different from the compromise in the Steele dossier. This took place early in 1987. You've asked a question I cannot legally answer. I think there is compromise. Whether they were released or not, I don't know. Some of it could be highly, highly embarrassing. Trump seems to be shameless, so nothing seems to bother him. He seems to be able to rationalize almost everything. If they do have one piece of compromise videotape, then that may well be shocking. But I think the whole story, he is owned by the Russian mafia. A lot of this is hiding in plain sight. The amount of money that has been laundered by the Russian mafia through Trump properties is probably in the billions of dollars. And he made out like a bandit that way. His entire success as a businessman is due to the Russian mafia.
Well, Craig Unger, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thanks for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Craig Unger, the author of the New York Times bestseller House of Bush, House of Saud, the former deputy editor of the New York Observer and editor-in-chief of Boston Magazine. He's written about the Trump-Russia scandal for the New Republic and Vanity Fair, and his new book just out is House of Trump, House of Putin, The Untold Story of Donald Trump and the Russian Mafia. We're going to take a brief station break and back looking into claims by the Russian Ministry of Defense that their military involvement in Syria was much more extensive than previously thought. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Nicholas Harris, a fellow at the Center for a New American Security, who works in its Middle East and Security program. He's also a senior analyst at the Jamestown Foundation in Washington, D.C., and he was the 10th Andrew J. Bashevich, Jr., USA Fellow at the Center for New American Security, and is the author of From the Bottom Up, A Strategy for U.S. Military Support for Syria's Armed Opposition. Welcome to Background Briefing, Nicholas Harris.
Thank you for having me, Ian.
And what do you make of this video issued by the Russian Ministry of Defense that essentially boasts of a much deeper involvement of the Russian military in Syria, with Russia having deployed 63,012 military personnel who saw combat experience in Syria? Its air force, they claim, destroyed 121,466 terrorist targets, killing 86,000 so-called militants, and they tested 230 new weapon systems. So I guess, first of all, do you take them at their word?
No, I believe that Russia has had a significant military presence over the last 3 years, almost 3 years now. We're very quickly approaching the 3-year anniversary of Russia's September 2015 intervention in Syria. The number of service personnel that they claim have been in Syria, the number of targets destroyed, and fighters of the armed opposition they've killed, I take with a grain of salt. I do, however, buy that for a current generation of Russian military officers and enlisted members, the Syrian conflict has been the defining moment of their career. And certainly the Syrian conflict has been a wonderful venue for Russian arms manufacturers to showcase their weaponry and for Russian military corporations to show their stuff. But the type of force presence that Russia is claiming to have in Syria does seem to stretch the imagination a bit.
Could they have rotated that many people through? I mean, the impression they're giving is that they've treated the Syrian civil war as a training exercise for their military.
There is no doubt that the Russians have deployed tens of thousands of service members to Syria. I've seen some figures as high as 50 or 55,000. To say that you have upwards of 86,000 service members that have rotated into Syria and have participated either in combat operations or in support of the Syria, of Bashar al-Assad's forces does seem high. However, you know, this does highlight a very key point, Ian, which is although there's been a lot of discussion about Russia's military intervention in Syria, we actually don't really have very good intelligence or information in the public domain about, you know, just to what degree is Russia invested in Syria militarily and how much military infrastructure does it actually have. We have bits and pieces of information. We have good insights into the number of air sorties they've conducted, and the figures that they've provided for air sorties does seem quite accurate. But in terms of actual service members, it's opaque.
So when Vladimir Shamanov, the head of Russia's Duma Defense Committee, says that not only did Russia test 200 new types of weapons, that they had a direct and positive impact on Russian arms sales, and saying it's not an accident that today they are coming to us from many directions to purchase our weapons, including countries that are not our allies. And in March of 2018, Vladimir Kozin, a senior aide to Russia's President Putin for military issues, boasted, "It's no wonder the Middle East countries want to buy Russian weapons that have proven to be effective." So what do you make of those claims?
I mean, it's a wonderful marketing pitch, and there's a significant degree of truth to the fact that the Russians have been able to use their combat operations in Syria as a showcase for their advanced weaponry. And there's no doubt about that. I think, Ian, though, that one of the challenges for Russia moving forward is that the United States hasn't withdrawn its military presence in the Middle East. The United States continues to operate as a key training partner for many Middle Eastern militaries. And also in terms of interoperability, many of the militaries, at least in the Arab countries, want to remain interoperable with the United States, which makes it difficult for the Russians to get too much market share when it comes to selling arms. I think, though, that even beyond the sale of weaponry, what Russia has accomplished quite well is that it's reasserted its position in Syria, which it's had for over half a century now, but also it's had the opportunity to expand the air base at Hamamin in Latakia in northwest Syria into the type of sort of wheel for future Russian military operations in the Middle East and in the Eastern Mediterranean that would rival what the United States has with the Al Udeid base in Qatar, which started out as an airfield and then expanded into a mega base as a result of the almost two-decade-long war on terror. So I do think what Russia has achieved, more than even arms sales or training its service members, is that it's been able to put itself in a position where it's perceived as being back at something like the height of where it was during the Cold War in terms of its ability to impact events in the Middle East.
And again, I'm speaking with Nicholas Harris, who's a fellow at the Center for New American Security, working in the Middle East Security Program. He's also a senior analyst at the Jamestown Foundation, and he served as the 10th Andrew J. Basevich Jr. USA Fellow at the Center for New American Security, and is the author of From the Bottom Up, A Strategy for U.S. Military Support for Syria's Armed Opposition. And when they made the claim, the Russian Ministry of Defense, that the Air Force, the Russian Air Force, destroyed 121,466 terrorist targets, killing 86,000 so-called militants. There was no mention of the 8,000 civilians that they killed and the fact that they very callously and deliberately targeted hospitals, et cetera, and ambulances. So I guess that's not surprising. But still, what's your sense of what the civilian casualties were in terms of the 86,000 that they're talking about?
Well, I'll start by saying that I am skeptical of the 86,000 figure. This is just as a general assessment of the types of forces on all sides that are engaged in Syria. There has been a decline in number of armed opposition fighters throughout the course of the war. Russia intervened in 2015. Russia focused a lot of its targeting on the armed opposition in western Syria that most threatened Assad. It wasn't until later on, late 2017, parts of this year in 2018, that they've targeted ISIS, for example. I would say that the Russians have definitely taken on a no-holds-barred and scorched-earth approach to fighting Assad's opponents, that the Russians understood very early on that this wasn't a war that was going to be won with a soft touch. I mean, fundamentally, the Syrian civil war is about a conflict between communities, about a conflict between irreconcilable differences in terms of the vision of what should be Syria. And Assad represents a very particular polarizing ally. And so the Russians have had to essentially degrade opposition society from the foundations. And so it's not a surprise that Russia would target hospitals, it would target bakeries, it would target other sort of community assets, because fundamentally Russia was fighting a total war and Russia understood what it was doing. Russia understood because it had a long experience in Syria because it was an ally of Hafez, Bashar's father. And Hafez had this viewpoint that if Syria was beginning to crumble, he would need to make sure that he stood over the rubble. And so this is where we are. And this is that would explain Russia's approach to fighting the Syrian civil war.
But speaking of rubble, who is going to rebuild Syria? That seems to be a key question. And Vladimir Putin met a few days ago with Angela Merkel, where they discussed rebuilding Syria. And Putin was basically shaking her down for money. And the implied threat that Putin is exercising over the Europeans is that Russian military intervention in Syria, when the Russians intervened, shortly thereafter, there was a massive exodus of Syrian refugees into Europe, and it's hardly a coincidence. And at the time, the Supreme Commander, Allied Commander of Europe, said that Russia had weaponized refugees. So from what I understand about what went on in the talks between Putin and Merkel, because they were discussing how to repatriate a lot of the Syrians who are causing social division in Europe, stimulating a lot of sort of racism, and the number three party now in Germany is a kind of anti-immigrant party, similar to what's happening here in the United States in terms of demagoguery. But nevertheless, I think there's a real component of incompatibility in Western Europe. So this is the game that's being played now. So what do you understand, Nicholas, about who's going to reconstruct Syria? Because to my mind, to the victor go the spoils, as the saying goes. To my mind, the Russians and the Iranians ought to be the ones that reconstruct Syria.
And Russia wants to avoid reconstructing Syria, or at least paying for it. And the Iranians want to avoid being responsible for that because they've already achieved their goals. I mean, fundamentally, both Russia and Iran have achieved their long-term strategic goals in Syria. Assad's regime will remain in power in western Syria unless there's a true black swan event. Russia has, as I mentioned earlier, expanded its military presence inside Syria. The Iranians, for all intents and purposes, have turned Western Syria into strategic depth for Hezbollah in the next war against Israel. So in the next war against Israel, because of the missile infrastructure the Iranians have built in Western Syria, the Israelis would have to go all the way to Damascus, and the tens of thousands of missiles raining down on them. But in terms of reconstruction, I mean, you know, Ian, we've entered the next phase of the Syrian conflict, which is the war over the aftermath of the war in Syria. And that conflict is much more difficult for the Russians because it requires an international consensus that normalizes Bashar al-Assad. And what I read from the discussions between Angela Merkel and Vladimir Putin was a strong undercurrent of Putin trying to convince Merkel that it was time to put aside any rhetoric that Assad must go. It was time to put aside any rhetoric that there was any alternative to Assad in Syria. And it was time to accept the plain facts that if she wanted the Syrian refugees to leave so she could remain in power, she had to accept Assad, and she had to be willing to put pressure on the European Union to take its foot off the neck of Assad with the sanctions that's implemented. And so this is where we're at. This is where we're entering these backroom devil dilemma type deals that Putin is offering to Europe in particular, saying, if you want this nightmare to end, I can end it for you, but you have to wake up to Assad as a reality.
But isn't there also the component that Putin is implicitly threatening Merkel and Western Europe because of this new offensive that they're about to engage in along with Assad to recapture Idlib, the last foothold of the opposition? That will definitely create a refugees, will it not?
Well, and it's also a threat to Turkey. First and foremost, it's a threat to Turkey. And right. We've entered the point in the Syrian conflict, the phase in the conflict, where literally Turkey is the only stand-in anti-Assad state that has any type of ability to shape the course of this conflict. And that includes the United States. Fundamentally, if Turkey decides that it's willing to be the sheriff of northwest Syria, the sheriff of the greater Idlib zone, and it's willing to take on the al-Qaeda organizations and the al-Qaeda fellow traveler organization Hayat Tahrir al-Sham and its fellow groups, Turkey can hold on to a large zone in northwest Syria. I mean, this is where we also get in to sort of with the broader U.S. strategy. The Trump administration has recently appointed Ambassador Jim Jeffrey to be its Syria envoy. It's appointed retired Colonel Joel Rayburn to be its Deputy Assistant Secretary of State for Strategic Levant issues. And my understanding of what the administration is going for is to achieve a modus vivendi with Turkey that would keep the Turks invested in northwest Syria, that would keep the U.S. partners, the Syrian Democratic Forces Coalition, in power in eastern Syria, to create a NATO-like zone stretching from Deir ez-Zor to Latakia, which would control more than half of the country's territory, most of its water, wheat, and oil resources, and would be the site of a near-permanent NATO military presence. I mean, so this is also sort of what Putin is trying to stave off right now, because the longer that Assad goes without being normalized by Europe, the greater the risk to Putin that the Trump administration implements this strategy and makes it far more difficult for Russia to win the war over the aftermath of the war in Syria.
Yeah, but Trump and Erdogan are at loggerheads. They're both autocratic, egotistical people who Trump feels that Erdogan betrayed him. They had a private discussion at the NATO summit recently about getting this American pastor out of jail. And Trump is furious with Erdogan that he feels he reneged on that deal. And tensions between the U.S. and Turkey couldn't be higher, whereas Russia and Turkey are making up. So wouldn't that affect that calculus?
So this is true. President Trump and President Erdogan, currently have pretty strong disagreements with each other. Both of these disagreements are actually tied to both to President Trump and President Erdogan's domestic political bases. So it is a sort of, it is a matter of re-election and reasserting their power within their own base in each of the respective countries. I would say that, you know, Russia and Turkey have been long-standing frenemies, if you will. They've had to engage pragmatically with each other as neighbors for centuries. They've also competed with each other as neighbors and great powers for centuries. That in Syria, Russia and Turkey are rivals, but they are rivals of a different scale than, let's say, the United States and Russia are. And I think this is important in the sense that it is, there continues to be strong bilateral relations between the United States and Turkish militaries and the United States and Turkish intelligence agencies. And there is a pathway or a joint vision for the future of Syria between the United States and Turkey in a way that there isn't quite the same pathway between Turkey and Russia, because Russia still has to manage Assad and its regime. And fundamentally, the Baath deep state that supports Bashar al-Assad in Damascus can't accept the fact that Turkey could have an indefinite zone of control in northern Syria that would stoke the Baath party's memories of how Turkey seized large chunks of Syrian territory and turned it into Hatay province, which is in modern-day Turkey. So there is this challenge for the Russians in that, yes, the United States has to manage its relationship with Turkey, and it's been quite fraught over Syria over the last 3 years. But at the same time, Russia has to manage Assad, and Russia has to manage Iran. And both Assad's regime and his deep state and Iran have different visions than a stabilized, carved-up Syrian space that over time slowly becomes reintegrated into a center in Damascus, which is essentially what the Geneva process has become. But there's a lot of road ahead yet for the Russians to travel.
Well, Nicholas, I think you've given us a very, very interesting and thoughtful picture here, and I thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Nicholas Harris, who's a fellow at the Center for a New American Security, who works on the Middle East Security Program. He's also a senior analyst at the Jamestown Foundation, and he served as the 10th Andrew J. Basevich Jr. USA Fellow at the Center for New American Security, and he's the author of From the Bottom Up, a Strategy for U.S. Military Support for Syria's Armed Opposition. We're going to take a brief station break and back go to Iowa City to discuss how the death of Molly Tibbetts has become politicized by President Trump and Iowa's Governor Kim Reynolds and amplified by Fox News over the objections of members of the victim's family. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24-7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now from Iowa City is Timothy Hagel, a professor of political science at the University of Iowa, who teaches judicial politics and behavior, American politics, and public administration. Welcome to Background Briefing, Timothy Hagel.
Thank you.
And this tragedy of the young woman who was jogging and was murdered by an undocumented immigrant from Mexico has become a political issue, particularly with the president making an issue out of it, and it's been all over Fox News. There's been very little coverage of Manafort's convictions and Michael Cohen flipping, but an awful lot of reporting on this, and particularly with a lot of emphasis on the suspect being an illegal, as they keep saying. So how's it playing locally?
Well, it's a combination of things. I mean, my initial thought was that we might see a difference in terms of how the situation is handled nationally versus how it would be handled within the state. And I think for by and large, that's what's happening, in that you see President Trump made comments about it right away, as did a number of other people. But even within the state, certain office holders, both senators, Republican senators Grassley and Ernst from Iowa, and Governor Kim Reynolds, a Republican as well, had made comments about it. The difference sort of there, though, is that we don't have any senators that are up for re-election this time. In other words, neither Grassley nor Ernst is on the ballot. Reynolds is. We do have a gubernatorial election. But I kind of thought that, at least as far as the congressional candidates, particularly in the first congressional district, which contains the county where this occurred, that it probably wouldn't come up as an issue, at least by the incumbents, that they sort of understand that there's, you know, the family would maybe want a certain amount of privacy or maybe not want it to be political. And unlike some other states, Iowa doesn't have the immigration issues that particularly border states might have. We have had certain things happen here, the Postville raid back in, was it 2008, something like that, 2008, I guess it was. So we've had those incidents here, but it's not an issue the way it is in some other places. So I think the focus would be more on the family, especially initially, but there's certainly understandable that it becomes a political issue as well, given who the perpetrator of the crime was.
So people in Iowa, they're responding to some of the victim's relatives, particularly Tibbetts' aunt, who posted on Facebook that evil comes in every color. My understanding from the CBS affiliate, the reporting of Todd Nagel, who's talked to the family, that they're not happy with their daughter's death being politicized.
And that's certainly understandable. I mean, for them, it really doesn't matter, I'm sure, who did it. It's the fact that they have lost their daughter, their sister, their friend, and so forth, and that's the thing that's of particular importance. But we've also seen, and this is an unfortunate part of the world we live in today, where people outside that core group will see sort of additional factors and take it and try to score political points. And I've seen that in both ways, where both, of course, you saw this, you mentioned, as we just mentioned, in terms of national politicians from the president and others that make it and sort of focus on the political side of things, because that is an issue that is something that we're talking about now and talking about ahead of the midterm elections, but other people talking about it in terms of, I saw one tweet, somebody said, talk about toxic masculinity and, you know, things of that nature. So there are always factors that can kind of influence it, which is always unfortunate because, again, as far as the family is concerned or the immediate survivors of some situation like this, that's not their focus. Their focus, at least initially, is on trying to get past this terrible thing that's happened to them.
There was a memorial, I believe, or a vigil for Molly Tibbetts. Was it on? I'm not sure it was on your campus, but brother also, of course, spoke out against what happened, but also against the politicization. And apparently, his sister Molly was a very active feminist and a big supporter of Michelle Obama's. So it doesn't sound like her politics gel with the president's politics.
Yeah, that vigil, one of them, I think there were two. One was on the campus here at the University of Iowa in Iowa City, and the brother spoke that I didn't happen to attend, but I saw some of the reports on it. And at least as far as the published thing, that they basically tried to stay away from the politics of it. But as far as an individual's politics, that really doesn't necessarily affect how anybody's going to interpret that kind of situation, but it does provide, in some sense, an odd contrast if maybe somebody's saying, look, this is an example where we have to strengthen border security or what have you, build a wall or what have you, when maybe the person that ended up being the victim was opposed to that particular policy. But the point, I suppose, from one point of view is that it doesn't matter what the politics of the victim were, that you want to try to solve this problem. But, of course, people on the other side see a different solution, and so we're back sort of to the political side of things, which, again, is unfortunate, but it tends to be how things work these days.
Well, the political side of it, of course, comes up in terms of the suspect, Christian Rivera, who's a 24-year-old farm worker who worked on a farm that is co-owned by two brothers, one of whom is a prominent Republican, and they've been very much on the defensive, the two brothers, about the fact that the suspect who President Trump talks about being an illegal, the lawyer, of course, said no, that he wasn't, that he was documented, and that was reported yesterday by Reuters. But it looks like with further investigation, his documentation was based upon false information, and the federal e-verify check system was circumvented by these phony papers that he was able to present. So presumably he had somebody else's social security number. So what's happening there in terms of local coverage? Is the co-owner of the farm, the prominent Republican, are they on the defensive? Because it seems like it brings up the question of whether, on the one hand, you can advocate for a wall, but on the other hand, rely on cheap immigrant labor.
Yeah, and it's one of those things where it's, as is often the case, where you have a combination of factors that are in play here. And aside from the wall issue, that often Republicans want to have this, what's called the e-verify thing, as you mentioned, where there's an electronic database that has this information that you can check to see whether somebody is here legally that has a work visa and things of that nature. And if you happen to be a Republican and weren't using that system, especially somebody who, again, it's the co-owner here, family member that was a Republican candidate for the nomination for agricultural secretary here in Iowa, and it would be embarrassing for that somebody to be circumventing that type of thing. Well, so that's why they're to some extent on the defensive, saying, look, we did what we thought was necessary in terms of checking this person's identity and documentation, but the person was using false documentation. And there seemed to be some, as you mentioned, there was some back and forth yesterday. I just got out of class, so I haven't seen the reports today as to sort of where we are on that, but certainly the press conference on Tuesday when they announced that they had found her body, that the, I don't know if it was the sheriff of the county or the local police that mentioned, and they used the phrase illegal alien, and then later we heard about the e-verify, and then later, as you said, the lawyer indicated, well, no, he was here legally, but that didn't seem to be the case. So not clear exactly where we are on that, but as you indicate, the owners of the farm basically wanted to say, look, we did what we were supposed to do, and again, we have to see if in fact they did everything they needed to, and if they did, then, you know, it's a sad situation for them as it is for everybody else, especially the family.
Well, given that the co-owner of the farm ran for agricultural secretary, I imagine in an agricultural state like Iowa, that's an important role, and I guess the second question would be, how much does agriculture in Iowa depend upon immigrant labor?
Well, it does to a certain amount. We have, of course, a lot of processing plants, and there was a sort of infamous situation about 10 years ago where there was a raid on a plant in near Postville, Iowa, that was using people that were not here legally and did not have proper work permits and so forth. And so we don't have the problems that a lot of border states have in terms of numbers of people coming across and so forth. But it's an issue here as it is in other places. And so whether it's the question, I guess, is whether the people that are laboring in these areas or in these plants processing meat processing and so forth, whether they're here legally, immigrants or not, is, at least from one point of view, isn't really the issue. The issue is whether if they're here as immigrants, if they're here legally, that they have work permits or whatever it happens to be. And again, in this particular instance, this person had some documentation that apparently was falsified or somebody else's, something of that nature. So it looked like he was somebody that was allowed to work or legally allowed to work, but turned out to not be the case.
Well, there are echoes, of course, of the Kate Steinle death in San Francisco, which Donald Trump did speak about in the 2016 campaign. He made an issue out of it. And it turned out that the undocumented Mexican who had a terribly long crime record, who was initially accused of murder, it turned out, and he was acquitted because he was sitting on the park bench on the pier in San Francisco, and he picked up underneath the park bench, there was a turned out to be a policeman's 9mm that somebody had stolen. He picked it up and, fiddling with it, it accidentally went off. And the bullet ricocheted up and hit Kate Steinle in the heart and killed her. It's just one of those horrible, horrible, horrible things all around. It's just tragic, but it nevertheless didn't stop Donald Trump from politicizing it.
Right. And again, as you say, that the problem for the prosecutors in that case was the sort of the intent and how it happened and so forth. And as you described it, they really couldn't convince a jury, at least, of that there was an intent factor in order to make the charge. Well, that doesn't seem to be the problem here. And then, of course, you can make the arguments, and some have already, saying, well, look, this could have happened to, it could have been anybody that did this to Molly Tibbetts. Or any other victim. There have been other people's as well. We had a situation 2 years ago, a little more than 2 years ago at this point, of a woman by the name of Sarah Root, who was actually, she's an Iowa citizen, but killed in Nebraska by a drunk driver who was also in the country illegally, that then fled, was out on bail and fled. And so Senator Grassley and some others are trying to get something passed called Sarah's Law that would help to prevent people from skipping bail and, you know, basically fill some of the cracks in the system. So it's not like Iowa hasn't seen this sort of thing before. And basically, with regard to the Molly Tibbetts situation, it looks like that there's clear situation for murder. Of course, he's got to go to trial, and we'll see if there's any kind of a deal made along those lines. But again, because of that, it's not surprising, given the issues that people are arguing about over immigration, that it does become a political issue. Again, it's a sad thing. It's sad that it's happening. More than sad, it's terrible that it has to happen so quickly after one of these events happens, but not just in a situation like this, but unfortunately we see this in other types of situations where there's an attack of some sort, people are killed, and it's almost at lightning speed these days that, you know, people with their own political points of view will start to emphasize it. And it's not one side that does it exclusively. You see that really on both sides, where people are you know, saying, okay, we need to draw this conclusion or that conclusion, and often even before all the facts are in.
Well, just in closing, since Iowa is such a key political state with the Iowa caucuses, and already there are some politicians showing up in Iowa to make sort of exploratory, you know, testing the waters, I guess, dipping the toe in, how's this going to play locally? Do you think it's going to affect national politics?
You know, it has that potential to do so, in part because if you're starting to talk about the presidential side of things, that when you know, the national issues are going to be the things that are often discussed, and number of the people that are being talked about for the Democrats as potential candidates to make a run, that immigration is obviously an issue that they want to talk about in terms of not wanting to build a wall and trying to have other ways to fix the system. So they're certainly going to be talking to Iowa Democrats about that. And so in that sense, at least as far as the more activist types of folks are concerned, both for the Democrats as well as Republicans, that will tend to be an issue that gets discussed. On the other hand, when it comes down to voting, especially when you're talking about a general election, in Iowa, the independents, what we call the no-party voters here, outnumber either Democrats or Republicans, and those are the folks that decide elections, and that's true for a lot of states. And so for a lot of folks, it's back to pocketbook issues, even despite the fact that other issues can become very important in the sense of taking up a lot of time on media and elsewhere as far as what we're sort of arguing about, and immigration is certainly going to be one of those issues.
Well, Timothy Hagel, I thank you very much for joining us.
My pleasure.
And again, I've been speaking with Timothy Hagel, who is in Iowa City. He's a professor of political science at the University of Iowa, and he teaches judicial politics and behavior, American politics, and public administration. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at backgroundbriefing.org. We can also contact me, and I'll be back again with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.